You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, folks. You're listening to the 3CR Garden Show. It's another spring 3CR show. Lovely drop of rain overnight for those that are listening to the show live. My name's John Arnott, and this morning we have a terrific 3CR Garden Show panel lined up. On the panel this morning, we have Claire Farrell, who's Associate Professor of Green Infrastructure and Director of the Burnley Campus. That's quite the title, Claire.
It is a bit of a mouthful these days.
Yeah. So welcome. Thanks for coming along.
No worries. Pleasure.
We also have Russell Lark, Head Gardener at the Melbourne Arts Centre Organisation. No, tell me what it is. I always get this wrong, Russ.
The Melbourne MAPCO. Arts Precinct Corporation.
The Melbourne Arts Precinct Corporation.
We can talk about what that means. I should change my title too to Emperor of the Garden, I reckon, so I can hang with Claire.
So in your role at MAPCO, Russ, you're responsible for the horticulture and management of the Larkbunda Test Garden and the subsequent rollout of what is a really ambitious green project in the heart of the Melbourne Arts Precinct. So thanks for coming along, mate.
Thanks for having me.
And Emmeline Bowman, Director and Founder of STEM, Landscape Architecture and Design Practice, here in Melbourne.
Yep.
Northcote.
Well, Melbourne. Rural Victoria. Yeah. Got something.
Wherever the work is.
Yeah, we got, and we have another one potentially in Queensland, and we've got one in Queensland, but we could have another one and then one in New South Wales. So we do go all out big farm properties and things like that.
Yeah. Do you have a preference for scale?
No, I do like working on farms and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the bigger landscapes. I think it's a bit more of a challenge. Actually, I got a really... I'll put the picture, but I've got a really cool picture of one where we've done like a whole re-veg of... We tried to recreate this meadow on the hill.
At landscape scale?
Yeah, it's big. It's but this one's in Macedon, and I just got a photo last week, and I was like, yes, it's been the 2-year mark, and it's looking real good, even though I get real scared.
Yeah,
because you're like, oh god, did the bruise eat it?
What's it going to be like?
You do get really stressed because you're sort of like you know what you're doing, but at the same time, you don't know what the elements are going to do, especially on such an exposed site. This is on a hill, and I'll get.
Do you track projects? Like you must have done literally hundreds of projects over the years.
Yeah, it's funny you say the staff has started it. I don't know where they all are. Like I'm just, but the staff are starting to do it.
Oh wow, yeah.
So we planted this hill. It's got
beautiful.
It's like Chrysocephalum, Semipoposum. We've put rocky outcrops to sort of replicate a basalty outcrop.
Because that's stony rises.
Yeah, because that's what's happening on top of the hill. Mm. And then we've linked, we've took some plants that are still remnant because all the roos and the sheep that were on there ate it all. But around the rocks you can find like all the bulbines, you can find the pelargonium. So we actually took some of it and brought it down. The seed... We tried to do it with seed, it didn't really work and we didn't have time, but we just took some of the plants out that were like quite prolific in certain spots, popped it all through here, put a whole range of like the local grasses. We worked with Western Plains Flora and Sunbury. We have different types of pimelias. It's really hit the mark. Like it is yellow.
Oh, that looks amazing. We'll have to take a picture of that and put that onto the social media.
Yeah.
But that's at landscape scale. That's just, that's several hundred square metres or, bigger than that.
It's bigger because it ends up going, beyond the hill.
Yeah, right. Amazing.
Yeah.
So who maintains that?
No one.
Wow. Okay.
It's just, yeah, with no one. Like,
because it's such a different style of landscape. Like, you know, if you've got a regular person, for want of a better term, to go in there to even ID a lot of those kind of Western Plains species and that sort of stuff.
That's, yeah.
That's amazing. So it's just doing its thing.
Self-sustaining.
That's what I believe.
It looks unbelievable.
The only thing we did is we had to put roo fences around because the roos were going in, and when we planted back the thymida, kangaroos love thymida.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And they just went right through and they just ate all that out.
Do you reckon that's why they called it kangaroo grass?
Oh, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've just got a hunch.
But also the kangaroo grass, they rely on it because when the kangaroos jump and they create the depressions into the ground, when that claw goes in, it causes that spot where the thymida seed head can drop down into the soil as
into
well.
Into the soil, start drilling in.
And then, yeah.
Thymida.
Hygroscopic seeds.
Hygroscopic.
Hygroscopic.
Please explain.
They drill themselves into the ground.
But is that for them? That's only for Ostrostyper.
And Thymida.
Thymida does too. Yeah. Oh, there you go. I don't know.
How old, question without notice, how old do you reckon a Thymida tussock can survive? You know.
Oh, I reckon ages.
Ages is a good answer.
I think.
It's ages.
Like 20 years more?
Plus.
50.
Wow.
So the example I'll talk to is at the Geelong Botanic Gardens in Eastern Park. So that was founded in the 1850s, 1856, and it had been cut for hay ever since. So very, very rarely has the Thymida been allowed to produce seed. And there's a cover of kangaroo grass at Eastern Park, and each individual tussock's about as big as this room, but dead flat.
Oh, it's flat.
So this is genetic material that goes back to the 1850s.
Really?
Wow.
You know, there's a hypothesis that material is genetic material that, you know, predates European.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so that's hundreds of years old.
Yeah.
Nice.
I mean, there's some incredible adaptations out there. I just saw John Morgan, who's a plant ecologist at La Trobe, talking about Tylotus macrocephalus and how those roots, like they have these huge tap roots and they can go down a couple of metres, and he called them like baby trees, you know, because you only like macrocephalus at most would get, the flowering heads would get to a metre or something and then they die back every year.
And the assumption that it's
but
a,
how old
a,
would that
a,
be?
A basis for
if it keeps popping up.
It's really extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing.
I remember there was a plant rescue done on the Western Ring Road, where the McDonald's is there, and look, there was some Pimelia, what would it have been? Pimelia.
Spinescens.
Yeah. So.
Ugly plant.
Yeah, what's.
Well, oh, I know, and I put that in this too, but it's growing, but it's not that pretty.
Yeah.
But it does the same thing.
Only a mother could love it.
It does the same thing. So we were at the zoo at the time, and we were engaged in sort of rescuing this plant material. And we thought, you know, this is only a little small thing, we should be able to dig it out. No way.
No.
It was like it has this broomstick root, as thick as a broomstick, that actually went down to about 1.5 metres.
It's amazing.
Straight into the ground. And the, you know, the foliage of it was less than a half a metre in diameter. You know, an extraordinary adaptation.
It's interesting. It's interesting you say that, because when I was planting at that project, you could actually see that starting of that stem. I was like, oh.
There you go.
Kind of like a little carrot.
It is just like a carrot.
Yeah, and I actually kind of was thinking that. I was like, it's not a normal root.
Do you know what's interesting about that horticulturally is people say, oh, you can have a drought-tolerant garden and it'll look good. Like some of these things are hanging on in the middle of summer, you know, when you go out there, especially like Mallee Country and stuff like that. And some of their roots are a metre and a half, two metres to get that. So there's a transition to horticulture where you actually have to irrigate these things to make them look good a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Sure.
So that, you know, generally they don't like moisture on their leaves in summer because of the humidity. But, you know, I just did plant of the week at the test garden, Eryngium ovinum, and they have these huge like tubers. But in 250 or 300 mil of substrate,
they
don't get that.
They've got nowhere to go.
So to keep them alive, you have to irrigate little and often. You know,
You must be finding that clear with some of the green infrastructure and roof gardens, just that lack of depth of medium.
The lack of depth, and it's interesting because we've done a lot on geophytes, so plants with underground storage, and things like Arthropodium milliflorum, which, you know, typically a geophyte that might die back and then come back again in the wetter seasons. On the green roof at Burnley, it's actually evergreen and develops great tubers and spreads itself and seeds and everything like that. So they always surprise you. I think you never know what things are going to do.
Yeah, definitely.
And that term geophyte, that relates to anything with storage under the ground?
Well, see, this is where you start to struggle with it, because technically a geophyte should seasonally go dormant.
Okay.
But then when you have geophytes in horticulture and they don't seasonally go dormant, are they still a geophyte? I don't know.
that's the big philosophical question for the day. I'm out.
I mean, Stopandrogloch is another one, because, you know, on rocky outcrops in, you know, Western Australia and other places. It's up and down, but it's evergreen fast in the landscape at Burnley.
Mm. Because it's irrigated throughout the year.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It doesn't have that hostile.
It doesn't trigger that summer dormancy thing.
Yeah.
Mm. Pretty interesting.
Look at Evans Street in the middle, like when it goes
Sunbury.
Sunbury. It would look good right now.
It would look amazing.
But yeah, that goes into that summer dormancy.
Yeah. Mm.
But you can imagine, like, because it's undisturbed ground, what's going on underground, those root networks.
Yeah.
They'd be sitting there waiting for the rains to come when it gets into the heat of summer.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'd be good to go there now.
It would be beautiful.
Especially after all this rain.
Yeah.
It'll be being looked after like a garden plant.
Yeah.
You're listening to the 3CR Garden Show, joined this morning by Claire Farrell, Russell Lark, and Emmeline Bowman. And producer this morning is Lubana. Thanks for keeping us going this morning, Lubana.
Thank you.
We'll just take a step to the side from our professional horticultural life, and I'd be really interested in exploring what you're doing in your home garden. What you're doing in your home gardens. And Claire, we had a discussion yesterday about the sort of the distinction between Claire the home gardener and Claire the director and associate professor at Burnley. Two different entities almost.
Well, yeah, because I guess my professional life, most of it's working with native plants and things like the Woody Meadow Project. But at home, partly because the conditions are different and my garden's very small, I enjoy playing with plants that I don't get to work with. So things like dahlias and crazy tropical flowering kind of plants. So, yeah, home is fun, playful, low stress. And it's not to say I couldn't have natives and play with them too, but there is a little bit of a distinction there.
You make a distinction between what you do at work and what you do at home.
Yeah, well, I guess too, my home garden's very small, and it's winter shaded and then summer full sun. Okay. So it's one of those sort of terrace houses with that condition. And I guess for me, there are some natives, like I've got Indigofera in there and I've got scabolas and things like that, but it's really a spring, summer, autumn garden, and in winter it, you know, can just be a bit miserable. I need to work out bulbs, I think. But, yeah, so I guess the idea of a dry land kind of native garden just didn't really fit that concept for me.
No. And what's doing it in your garden at the moment?
Yeah, well, the dahlias have flowered, some of them, which is really exciting. I always try to get them before Christmas, so to have them up. And they were put in pots pretty much mid-September, so to have flowers already, I'm pretty stoked.
Do you aim for the great big dinner plate, dahlias or things?
I like the small collarettes, ones from seed, and then some of the bigger balls, but no dinner plates. And they're a riot of tropical colours, so oranges, reds and pinks.
I wouldn't have picked you as a dahlia gal.
No, I wouldn't have either. I think COVID affected us all in different ways.
You think it might be a throwback to some of those days?
Yeah, I think so.
Rocking backwards and forwards, thinking, I've got to grow some dahlias.
It sounds trauma-related. Yeah.
When I think for me, like my parents, they live in Queensland, and so I do have sort of tropical garden roots, and I think dahlias are my way of having a tropical garden in Melbourne. Mm. And just, you know, you walk out there in the evening after work and you can just sit there with a glass of something and just feel like you're on a bit of a holiday, maybe.
You'd be at one with the dahlias.
Yeah.
What about you, Em? What's happening in your home garden?
I love dahlias too.
They're beautiful. Yeah.
I love when people come on, especially if it's like us and them, is like, I don't have any natives. It doesn't matter. I love everything.
You wouldn't judge you on air anyway.
I have... like I've had this ongoing renovation, never stop. So, you know, I'm careful with my garden because the builders tend to step on everything. But I do have one patch that I've been looking after, and I basically like to replicate what we, you know, put in the ground for our clients. So I've done a lot. When we did our Mifkas garden a few years ago, I've created a patch pretty much like that. So I've got, you know, all your arthropodiums, I've got Liberdia paniculata, I've got orthoxanthus flowering at the moment, I've got amobiums, I've got different types of baronias. It looks like a very colourful fairy meadow garden at the moment. And it's looking fantastic. Like, yeah. I don't feel like this garden is, like, you don't see it anywhere.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's very much like I like to investigate. I like to see how the plants perform in different locations too. So I've got a whole lot of, like, Leptorhynchus, tenuifolius and squamatus in different applications. Different spots. Some, you know, even in garden beds, which are doing really, really well because they tend to like the heat and they like the free-draining soil, but they like the wicking system. They're going bonkers at the moment. It's just got these little yellow little buttons everywhere. I just like to observe. And what animals sort of tend to eat them or don't eat them and all that sort of stuff. But,
So you work in Northcote. Your garden is
in the Yarra Valley. Hoddle's Creek, which is a bit wet. Right. And actually, yesterday when we were at Chloe had a little party.
She did.
For her book. And I was talking with Andrea Proctor. We were looking at the Camelaceum Paddy's Pink, which is a Camelaceum cross verticordia. Mm. And this plant in particular, we use a lot because even though it's like a hybrid thing from Western Australia, it can live in the wettest, coldest environments.
Yeah.
It's even growing in that botanical garden that Philip Johnson had done. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of West Australian species, which this might be controversial, but I think a lot of them might not have been too suited in certain parts.
Yeah, and quite a bit's dropped out.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, there's still some really nice stuff.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
But that plant in particular is going gangbusters in, you know, cold, wet environment. And I've got all that through there too.
Yeah,
which
sure.
is, and this is the thing, when you start to figure out where these plants sort of go, like, I'm sort of designed, so it's not really like science, but it's obviously trial, but a lot of it's about how this is going to look in other people's garden. What are these applications for those plants? We have this Paddy's Pink, like, you know, within rose gardens. So, like, trying to mix it up because people were like, I'm not a big fan of roses, except for the Roald Dahl rose. I like that one. But if I put the Camelaceum with the Roald Dahl, you get the pinks and then
beautiful.
This beautiful peachy orange. Yeah. And then they've got all these cut flowers and people don't even realise that, you know, you're sort of putting in these pollinator attracting plants that are really beautiful as well as cut flower.
Yeah.
I mean, what a great plant. It does the winter wet and cold. At Cranbourne, I mean, where it was at Cranbourne was probably a little wet.
Yeah, it's pretty damp.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's probably one of the few, like, Camelaceums or verticordias non-grafted in Victoria that you can just stick.
Yeah.
In those wetter conditions, and they flower forever. As well.
And you chop them, and they can come back.
Yeah. And they smell divine, like the foliage is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's a very good plant.
And the plant itself, just the form when it's not in flower. I mean, the foliage, I mean, it's a sort of a grey foliage, but it holds a corner of the garden.
Yeah.
Even just the foliage.
You can hedge them up too. Yeah.
And you can clip them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, Emily, what you were saying about, you know, you're a designer, you're not a scientist, but someone asked me recently what science was, and I just said, well, it's putting numbers to what you observe so you remember later.
Yeah, okay.
So
better count a few more than a little bit more counting.
Observation's key.
I mean, it's citizen science, maybe.
I mean, that distinction between science and home gardening, that's an interesting thing in and of itself. Horticulture is all about observation.
It is. I think the difference is if you're doing science, you can only change one thing at a time so that you know why you achieved the result you achieved. Whereas when you're practicing horticulture, you might try a few things and learn from them, but you couldn't definitively write a paper to say, this was the reason this worked.
Yeah.
But it's interesting too, Em. Like, I find this sort of naturalistic planting movement is such a good way to encourage play and encourage experimentation, because it takes the onus of anything having to be brilliant.
Yeah. Mm. And it gives you, I mean, for us, it just gives you more confidence in plants. Like even the Nicotiana suavolens, which we spoke, that has never stopped flowering. It just keeps going and going. I've had it in there nearly for, what, 3 years now. Put in the pot, dead. Put it in the ground, happy.
Do you know, full disclosure, I hated Nicotiana. And then I saw it in your Mifkus garden. I'm like, okay.
You should see.
It looks so good in there. Like just, they were floating.
Yeah.
They looked awesome.
But they're doing that in my garden.
Yeah.
And the plant itself is about, I'd say about 50 centimetres now wide. Like it's kind of falling over, but it keeps on just coming up with flower heads just like that.
Yeah.
And imagine that with all the arthropodiums. That's what it's doing in the garden. It's a stunning plant.
How tall is it?
At the moment it's sitting about 30, 40 centimetres. In that garden, I think, are at 40.
Yeah, gorgeous.
But it's still hitting that size.
Yeah.
Which species was suaviolens?
Suaviolens, my mouth doesn't move as well.
Because I have Langstorffii in my garden, which is, you know, an exotic one.
But it's very...
But I actually did root divisions of it to move it to my new garden. And, you know, I hadn't read that anywhere, but I was like, this thing just breaks apart on its own.
Mm.
So I'll try it, and it did. And like you, they're perennial, basically.
Yeah, I don't know if this... I don't think it's as hardy as that. I think if I rip mine apart, it'd be dead. I don't know. Yeah, but Russ, I don't like it.
No, I do
now. He likes it now.
Totally converted now.
Yeah. And what about your home garden, Russ? What's happening?
My garden's going insane at the moment. It is flowering
in a good way.
Head off. Yes, so good. I mean, it's probably too vigorous at the moment, and usually I'm a little bit more vigorous with the secateurs, but I'm letting things kind of do their thing a bit more in my garden. But I think there was like four of my plants that weren't flowering yesterday when I walked around the garden.
Wow.
So I've got like all of the paper daisies going crazy. I've got bowers, I've got Glyphs gricarian, I've got Bignoceros, I've got my Veronicas, like Prostanthras, like it's going mental.
Wow.
It looks so good. Callistemons are out. Like,
so with that, you must be
Pelargoniums.
All manner of Pelargoniums, Australian Rodney
Arnhem. Just Rodney Arnhem, yeah.
You must be getting all manner of wildlife, insects, invertebrates.
Yeah, it's the best year I've ever had in that garden. So I've been there for 4 years, and I think the rain's helped probably. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it's always wet at this time of year, like we were talking about this before, but there's been a little bit extra. So I think the insects are doing their thing. So I've got a Mobium elatum at the moment, which is like the winged everlasting.
Which is a beautiful thing.
Oh, my God, I walked out there yesterday and there were drone flies and hover flies and normal flies and butterflies and, you know, all sorts of stuff on there. And that was throughout my whole garden. So
fantastic.
You got to be careful with this. Like, you wouldn't plant it near bushland or anything. Like, they have a tendency to self-seed and escape into, you know, roadsides and bushland and things like that.
Where is it native to? Like, what's South its Australia? Sort of home range?
Oh, New South Wales.
Yeah.
And then you've got the top kind of corner of Victoria. So it's actually endangered in Victoria, which is one of the quirks of, you know, like being in Vic and drawing lines on a map.
Yeah.
Having said that, those populations are actually really interesting genetically, usually, those disjunct populations. So they're actually really important to conserve because they're at the tail end of those ranges. So, you know, most of those things without connectivity are starting to speciate and do their thing. So they're actually quite important. People go, oh, well, is it, you know, there's heaps in New South Wales or whatever, but not quite, you know. Yeah, they're still doing their own thing.
Yeah,
so, But I'm just enjoying my garden, really. I'm not doing anything apart from sitting in there and looking at native bees and bugs and, you know.
And I saw a prompt on social media yesterday saying, are you documenting that through things like iNaturalist?
Yeah, sometimes I do. I'm lazy with iNat. I'm usually like, if I don't know what it is, I'll throw it on iNat just so I can get an ID.
I was going to ask with the Amobium, we've been playing with the silver form and the green form.
Mm.
And it's funny because the silver form is a way better plant.
Yeah.
It's got like better structure. It stays upright. And the green form flops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Do you know why? No. And do you know why the difference in the colour range, like where those locations are?
Yeah, I don't know actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have something to do with the condition that they were collected in and the little patch.
Because we literally put them together because we want to see like how they cross over too. Because these things are like they do weed. They can go bonkers.
Yeah, they can.
But, yeah, you put them together. We've put some together because we want to see what happens when they start crossing over and what we get out of that and which one's going to be more vigorous.
Are you getting anything?
We've only just put it. We've done the two this year. So we've put the silver ones mostly through and the indigenous stock that we got from – it was down New Ceres and you can get it from Goldfields, but – they were slightly varied, so then we just start putting them in for a bit of hybrid vigour.
Beautiful.
But, yeah, which is not what we'd like to do.
Hybrid vigour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good. Keep them strong.
That's the art of plant selection and cultivating over years, and we're only just starting to explore that in some respects with the Australian flora.
Yeah.
We're so young.
Yeah, so young.
Yeah.
Things like camellias and roses and, you know, some of the irises, a whole bunch of those things have been worked on for centuries. You know, we're only just starting to explore that stuff.
Well, just like last time I was talking about that crossed pelargonium with the Rodnianum and Nostril.
Yeah.
It's a great plant, this cross.
Yeah.
Real good.
That's a ground cover?
Yeah. It gets, like, it's kind of becomes a bit shrubby, it gets to about 25 centimetres, but fantastic, like, hybrid.
Mm.
Good foliage, pink flowers. Yeah, because some people, the Austral can be a little bit more cabbagey, hairy.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone
it's scrubbier.
Yeah, it can. Yeah. And then the Rodnianum is beautiful, but it's a bit too delicate in the foliage, but then the beautiful flowers. And this, you literally got the combination. And the leaf changes, got these really big leaves, but they're shiny, like the Rodnianum. Yeah, very good.
Because there's a species of pelargonium that grows up around Benambra, which has got maybe similar qualities to that.
Okay. Interesting.
There you go.
Stylarum.
Stylarum.
Oh, we use them, but it's not like Stylarum. No, but we do like that one too. Yeah.
You're listening to the 3CR Garden Show. My name's John Arnott, joined this morning by Claire Farrell from Burnley Gardens, Russell Lark from MAPCO, Emmeline Bowman from STEM Landscape Architecture and Design. We've got a terrific show lined up of, usual Sunday morning chit-chat, garden show chit-chat. If you'd like to call in with a question for the panel, you can call in on 9419 10155. I got that wrong. Hang on. Yeah. 94190155. I've got it written down wrong in my notes. And you can text a question through to the text line on 0488 809 855. And just to repeat the number if you want to call in, 94190155. And we've actually got a text message which has come through this morning. Morning, everyone. Two questions. I bought a Scedoxys multiflorus yesterday and wanted some advice on whether to put it in the garden or leave it in a pot based on its watering requirements over summer winter. So that sounds like it might be one of those bulby geophyte things. Scedoxys, what's the species? Scedoxys multiflorus. I'm getting a bit of blank stuff, so we'll move on. The second, we're just doing a bit of Googling there.
Oh, never seen it.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I've never heard of it. I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. We'll carry that.
South African.
I believe Jane is going to be on the show next week, so we'll take that as homework.
Jane will definitely.
Yeah, we'll carry. So we'll carry the Scedoxys question over to week when Jane Tonkin's on. Secondly, I was hoping that Russell could talk about the scoria mix for the soil at Lark Bundark project for ongoing nutrition.
I have an even better person to talk about the scoria mix because Claire was directly involved in creating the scoria mix. So I'm going to defer to my associate professor right now. That's okay.
could we just provide the context? What's the scoria mix and what's the context?
Yeah, so basically it's loosely known as the Burnley mix.
This is the Burnley mix.
Different forms. So basically it's just a rooftop mix that is very light.
Okay.
That you can use in, you know, really shallow substrates.
As a growing medium.
As
a growing medium.
And the majority of it is scoria-based. Okay. So, yeah.
Associate Professor Claire Farrell.
Yeah, no fanball. No, John Rayner, he really worked to develop this substrate, but it is the Burnley mix, but essentially it's different grades of crushed scoria. Okay. So there's sort of 8 mil minus, so anything that would fall through an 8 millimetre sieve, and that makes up about 60% of it. Then there's 20% 7 mil aggregate scoria, so just the rock part. And that's to give more drainage and to sort of lighten up the density of it, because scoria is very aerated, so it's lighter when it's not got the fines. And then there's 20% composted coir, okay. And that's the organic matter. And so it's a low nutrient substrate, and that's so that you don't encourage weeds and you sort of moderate growth in those shallow substrates.
Okay.
But then we do add surface fertilizer. And generally what we apply is a quarter to even an eighth of the lowest recommended rate on a low phosphorus, slow release, 18 months to 24 months fertilizer. And then we tend to drag out the fertilizer regime, so we won't do it at the frequency they say. So if it was an 18 month slow release, we would probably reapply at the 3 year mark.
Interesting. So that's kind of creating conditions which are the opposite to optimum?
Yes. Yeah. So on green roofs and on structure where you will have fluctuating water availability. So because those substrates are so free draining, and they have to because otherwise you'll get flooding, they really can't support lax plants with lots of growth, and also they're hot. I mean, a green roof substrate can be 70 degrees in summer, so it's better to have plants that have grown a bit tough so that they can cope with those seasonal really hot and dry conditions, because you can go from having water to having none in a day. Yeah, it's sure. Not like the slow dry down you get in natural soils.
Yep.
And yeah. that is a challenge as a horticulturalist to manage. So, you know, if I get 2 days of above 20 and a little bit of wind in the test garden, I have to irrigate it, you know. So this is especially shallow. So, you know, most of the time substrates at 250, 300 would be succulent based and
irrigated a little bit.
The other thing is there's a bunch of plants in here that I personally haven't grown,
okay.
And a lot of these haven't been grown together. So there's not really a one size fits all for the test garden in a way. So I'm learning about these different species and how they're responding. So there's a whole bunch of kind of indicator plants that go off really early, like, okay. You know, the asters and echinacea and all of that sort of stuff. And I know within, you know, the next day I'm probably going to have to irrigate the garden. So, you know, part of my job is to feed some of that stuff back around what species are kind of working together. And we're also looking at, you know, we've just set up a trial with Claire at Burnley. I mean, you guys are doing sort of real sciencey stuff, and so are we. But we're looking at different species mixes and the amount of moisture they're getting, and we're going to play around with the fertilizer and just see what kind of impact that has, because on a large scale, you want to reduce the amount of management that you actually have to do. So in a way, you use stress as a management tool.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so you don't want heaps of weeds.
Yep.
You don't want this crazy growth.
Yep.
You know, and you kind of got to identify those species that are going absolutely mental, that, you know, there's a few things in the test garden for those who have been out there, like the Cystanthe and Isotoma, and like I've cut probably 50% of it out and still needs it. So, yeah, it's just learning how to manage those kind of landscapes before we build the big one, you know.
And that's the pure nature of the test garden, is that it is an experimental garden. And,
yeah.
And there's a formal relationship between MAPCO and Burnley?
Yeah, so at Burnley we're doing the plant trials for the Arts Precinct project. And so that's been a super exciting part of this, because not many public projects will do any research before they put it in. But this was actually part of the original brief for the project, would be that there would be research on the plants to inform the design. And we're doing it from a trait perspective, so it means that we're not so fussed what the actual plants are, but we're learning from the characteristics that they have, how good plants like them would perform in Lightbundup. So it's a really exciting thing, and Dean Shriek is leading the trials. And I think in terms of managing on those substrates, the experiments we're doing now, which are really exciting, are looking at plants that are resource acquisitive, so need lots of water, needs lots of nutrients, versus those that are conservative and slower growing, and seeing what the balance is when you put them all together,
yeah, sure,
and who wins. So with different levels of water, and that's really exciting.
Did you just say resource inquisitive?
Acquisitive.
Oh, acquisitive.
They ask a lot of questions.
Yeah. Why am I on this roof? So hot up here.
Yeah. So we put plants on this spectrum that's called the fast-slow plant economic spectrum.
Okay.
So you've got the slow, which just sit there doing their thing and don't really respond to resources.
And some examples?
Oh, let me think of something slow. So succulents tend to be slow,
yep,
because they've got their own thing. They don't have to really try sometimes.
Yep.
But then the cystanthi that goes nuts, that's on its own
league.
And
the isotoma?
Isotoma would be highly acquisitive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's also very drought tolerant. So it's one of those really super flexible plants, which is amazing. Slow plants would be things like Eutaxia, yeah, microphylla.
Okay.
And maybe even the Verticordia plumosa. Mm. And then fast, we have things like Isotoma, the Asters,
yeah,
all of those things that are just programmed to make the most of it when they have it.
Mm. It's fantastic. And this information, ultimately, it'll get published?
Yeah, ultimately, yeah, it'll get published, but throughout the project and working with Russell and Jack Semler and the Hassel team, it's informing the design at the same time. So we kind of have sort of two steps. We have the formal data analysis and presenting that, but we also have sort of our gut feels and the early data informing what goes on lists and things like that. And then we altogether are probably only looking at, I think it's 125 species that we can test really rigorously.
Sure.
And to the master list, which is past 400 species, basically we've been able to take those characteristics that classify the plant as fast or slow, interpret the master list, and make suggestions of where they'll work in the design on the basis of that. It's pretty groundbreaking,
yeah,
and absolutely
incredible.
Thrilling. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful.
I mean, horticulturally too, it's kind of interesting when you see, you know, two babies together that are working well,
yeah,
or, you know, some things that I collected years ago, like the Craspedia,
yeah,
Arantia, Var Jamesi, that comes from, like, the sub-Alps, is doing unbelievably well in much dry conditions. You know, plants, I've said this before, but plants are, you know, potentially a lot more plastic than you give them credit for. There's a couple of alpine poas that are doing really well, like Clivicola. And
that you wouldn't, that's based on where they come from, you'd say, you wouldn't even look at them.
Oh, you'd never put it in a rooftop mix.
No.
Like if you were, you know, if you'd never trialled them, there's no way you would even consider that,
yeah,
but they're doing really well. So that's kind of fun.
And you get the opposite too. I mean, plants that you think should work, like Leucophyta brownii,
mm,
is a complete dud for us, mm, every time we try to play with it in those substrates.
Mm. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, it'll sit there on a dune.
On,
yeah,
sand.
That's
on
right.
Sand. Pure,
yeah,
sand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, how fascinating.
But then we go back to the, you know, the traits and the roots and that sort of stuff. Like, they're accessing moisture in a different way.
Mm.
And
sure,
it's not,
yeah,
through these shallow substrates. Like,
sure,
they're throwing roots into sand and
maybe
tapping into, yeah,
deep, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
and the percentage, like, roughly, what's the percentage of Australian native plants to exotic plants, and is there a indigenous thread in there as well?
There is. I reckon it's probably, I mean, the final lists haven't been done, but I'd say like 35% native, something like,
yeah,
that. It kind of depends on the area of the garden.
Okay.
Like, it's divvied up into a couple of different areas.
Different,
so,
sort of rooms with different.
I'm going to say that loosely. There's,
yeah,
definitely,
okay,
a lot of indigenous plants, because there's been a lot of consultation with Wurundjeri aunties around,
sure,
what species they would like to see in the garden. So bulbines and arthropodiums and microceras.
The layers to this project are just bloody wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll explore that later in the show a little bit as well.
Yep.
Yeah. We do have a question which has come through from Anne from Northcote, so I'll try and bring Anne on the line. Anne, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks, John.
Now, you've got a question this morning about sweet peas.
Yeah, seems very simple when I consider the skills of the panel. Very skilled panel.
It's a good panel this morning, but yeah, we're very keen to hear your sweet pea question.
For the last couple of years, I've put in a variety of soft colours, but, you know, mixed. But I'm only really getting the really pale, like, pale violet, lilac, and maybe a bit of a pink and a bit of a lemon. Nothing too exciting compared to what I thought I'd get when I put the seeds in.
Okay.
And I just wonder, is that a pH thing or is that a survival of the fittest thing?
I think it's just the seeds they've given you.
Yeah, it just might be that in variability within the seed and maybe you've not got a completely diverse mix, even though that was on the packet, potentially.
Yeah, I read about this in England even. They were saying that they sort of started struggling with sweet peas because, you know, obviously they cross so readily. And so if people growing them for seed aren't careful about separating out the varieties so that they stay true to the variety. So they've actually put a lot of work in kind of isolating the good ones again and building up stock to give out seed. So, yeah, I'd say it's that the people growing the seed and then they're not as true to the variety as they should be anymore.
Mm.
Because they're mixing in an uncontrolled way.
Yep.
Yeah. Look, that sounds like that might be the cause of that. The seed batch is defaulting to those colours rather than being super diverse. It's probably worth providing some feedback to the seed company to that end.
It's probably worth mentioning that flower colour is highly selective, like when we're talking about, you know, especially species in the wild. So, you know, you might have a species that is, you know, a nice bright pink and maybe the pollinators don't like that. So if you have fields of pink or whites or purples, like, you know, you can find that selection works really quickly on a particular colour depending on the pollinators you have, especially when you're building a seed bank and that sort of
pollinator
stuff.
Pollinator preference.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's what guides evolution, really.
Yeah, sure.
You know, if you smell great and look even better, you're a fair chance of getting a pollinator to the yard, you know. So
these nurseries these plants out, pollinators go in, they're collecting the seed and the most strongest one will survive, the one that the pollinator tends to like. So then that's the percentage of colour you're going to get.
Yeah. And they might have the perfect mix out there, you know, a third pink, third purple and a third white. But,
but unless it gets pollinated in that ratio, you're going to get a different mix.
So, exactly. So she needs to find another company that specialises in the certain colour.
The pink ones.
Is it a mixed bag? Because sometimes you get those sweet peas and they're like, they give you a variety of colours in one packet. So I would say don't do that. Get specific varieties so then you kind of know your colour combinations.
I get that, but I do think that pollinator thought is very valid.
Mm. Yeah.
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 So look at that conversation that you just triggered from your sweet pea question. It's a ripper.
But first of all, before I go, is there an ideal pH for them? And is it okay to measure pH on a wet day like this? Or is that not smart?
Two good questions. Not sure about the pH preference of sweet peas. And in terms of testing?
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if you're using one of those, you know, pH kits that you can buy for home, because you have to wet that up anyway to apply your dye and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, the weather's not an issue. I think when you're testing pH, it's always really good to do it, to do multiple samples.
Okay.
Like you can, you know, if you might do something out of path and it'll be leaching of, you know, lime and your alkalinity will go through the roof. And just to make sure you do four or five around there.
Four or five?
You know, different depths as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, we go deep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes, I didn't think, but I did a pH test on my quinces because they were looking pretty awful.
Yeah.
But my gardening friend said you should have gone deeper because the mulch has affected the pH level, so... I didn't go deep enough to get a probably true reading.
What mulch are you using, just out of interest?
Yuki mulch.
Okay.
And just general clippings, not clippings, but when I'm pruning, I'll just leave them go dry and then I just stomp on them and, so what I've generally got in the garden, if it's not going to sprout, I'll use those sorts of things.
Yeah, okay. And is that mulch well-aged when you apply it? Because it can actually draw quite a lot of nitrogen out of the soil if it's quite fresh.
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes, yeah. I generally leave it in a bag for a while before I get to it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did what was the pH, just out of interest? What readings were you achieving?
On the Quince?
Yeah.
Look, it just said I needed lots of potassium.
Okay.
And I did that. I just loaded it up, but I think I might have OD'd. But the crop is coming now from that last experiment, so I'll see what the results are. They're only just babies at the moment, and I'll just see how it goes this year.
So the potassium will help with your flowering and your fruiting, but it won't do anything to the pH. Mm.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Mhm. All right. Okay, lovely.
Good on you. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Keep experimenting.
Thanks for calling in. Good on you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
No worries. We've got Carl in Croydon is saying, what is the name of the Verticordia cross?
Paddy's Pink.
Paddy's Pink, which should not like wet, but does.
Yeah.
So it's
like, I'm not saying put it in a pond or, but yeah, it can tolerate.
So you call it a chamoelorsium?
Yeah.
Paddy's Pink?
Yeah, chamoelorsium or chamoelasium, I say. Paddy's Pink.
Oh, sorry, sorry about that.
I
completely got sidetracked with the Paddy's Pink question.
But it is coming, like, I'm seeing it available everywhere now. Like, we were using it at, like, 2-3 years ago, and now it's everywhere. A bit like Monty's Blue, which is this plant that Russ has at the moment. Veronica Monty's Blue. They because they're crossed, they don't really give the whole name. It's just like Camellasium, Paddy's Pink.
Paddy's Pink.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some questions about the two pelargoniums that were crossed. It's Marnie would like you to repeat the names of the two pelargoniums.
It was Pelargonium rodnianum crossed with Austral.
Austral.
Yeah, and I think the name they're giving it is called Applause.
And is that purchasable?
No, you can't get it.
No. Okay.
Someone make it. I've been asking everyone to try and get onto it.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get.
One. Have you tried propagating it yourself?
Yeah, well, we're looking into it, but you have to. It's very hard, like, to get the cross. Yeah, I don't know.
But you could potentially do it vegetatively or through tuber division. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have the time or capacity, we have to get someone else to do it. Okay. But yeah, I've been talking with Cranbourne, but yeah, we'll see.
But it sounds like a plant that would be worth investing that energy into somewhere.
It is.
Along
yeah,
the line.
It is. Yeah. Very good.
You might be able to get some bigger flowers on the rodnianum too.
Well, I mean, this was just one place that did it, and you know, this is just one type. So what's the variation?
Yeah.
You know, this is why I love the native section, because look what was being created in a garden setting, like these crosses, it's exciting.
Well, that's what happened at Burrendong Botanic Garden and Arboretum with the Burrendong Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It turned up.
Yeah.
You know, there was Petty Laris and another Western Australian one
Of a plant.
Yeah, it's an amazing seedling.
Yeah, so this is why I just get so excited about it. And then at the same time, you still got it. They're looking after all our wildlife and pollinators and, you know, it's sort of, I don't know, it's just fun. It's just really exciting.
And that's where Monty's Blue came from. Is it chance hybrid in a garden?
Yeah, Arenaria.
Arenaria and Perfoliana.
And Perfolia,
It's gorgeous.
It's the greatest variety.
It is. It is. We've planted it through.
It's just a chance plant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the best. Like, we've planted it in so many, like, you know, these beautiful meadow gardens. In fact, we've actually done the similar combination with the Amobiums and these Veronicas. Flowers forever.
Yeah.
It's better than the Arenaria because Arenaria tends to flop over and it gets a lot of woody.
It's short-lived. Yeah.
Well, it's not, I don't know, because we've had some Arenarias in and this garden we've had nearly now is 3.5 years and they look great. We taught the guy how to, like, keep on top of them. I think it's all about how you prune it.
Yeah.
But this one, this next level, it stands upright, and if it is sort of flopping, just give it a hack back.
And a lot of the Veronicas are amazing in those kind of naturalistic style planting. So I actually put Monty's Blue in the test garden not long ago, and people don't recognise it as
they
a native.
Don't. They don't.
Texturally, it's really interesting. But also, you manage it in a very similar way. So it gets, you know, at the start of spring, you cut all the old stuff off and you're managing it in that kind of naturalistic perennial sense, which is cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, it's a herbaceous perennial.
Yeah.
Mm. It just happens to be native.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But it's so good.
And put a comment into the the chat about so many plants that we've talked about so far, and she's struggling to capture the names. I think what we'll do with this is that we'll take some pictures of it for the social media posts, and we'll post the names of the plants that we were riffing about this morning.
Yeah. And we get carried away. Sorry,
yeah,
Anne.
Yeah, yeah, we got really excited.
No, there have been a few plant names
I think
flying around the studio as well. But Anne also has a question about a camellia. Not sure exactly what type, but it's turned into a very tall, spindly tree with one skinny trunk, some sparse, small branches. Wondering if she can cut back a spindly camellia.
Oh, yeah, cut a camellia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they love a hack.
Yep.
Definitely.
And you could actually cut back into wood.
Talk to Claire. She loves to cut plants.
I do like to cut plants.
So, Claire, your advice for a spindly camellia would be cut back into wood?
Yeah, tough. I would. I mean, just think about tea plants. They prune them pretty harsh. Mm. So, yeah, I'd do the same.
Like, even if you just cut back, like if you don't want to get it right down to the base, but I would get some branches on it. Choose the form you want and bring it back.
Prune it to a shape.
Yeah. Prune it back, yeah.
Yep.
They're pretty resilient.
They're so resilient.
It's the Sancoroid japonica. Both of them respond pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you could actually take it right down to almost the ground level.
Yeah.
And produce it.
Yeah. Or like a lemon tree, like skeletonize it if you
want
to.
That's how I'm imagining. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I hope that's helpful, Ange. Good luck with the pruning. And now would be a fine time to be doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm.
Craig Castries put a message through with regards to the Bloom Festival, which is on today from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at All Green Nursery. There was a garden show that was cancelled early in the year by Wyndham Council. It must have been due to a weather event. But today at All Green Nursery, there is a Bloom Festival, heaps of storeholders, food vans, guest speakers all day, including Tina Crawford, David Little, Chloe Thompson, and Craig will be talking about soil. So the location for All Green Nursery is 130 Old Geelong Road in Hoppers Crossing. Mm. Sounds like a really nice event.
It does.
I think the rain is going to...
I think it's stopped now, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks like it has stopped, yeah. So it would be a terrific afternoon to get out to... I've just lost the address there, but the
Bloom Hoppers Festival. Crossing.
Hoppers Crossing. Yeah. Thanks, mate. One of our listeners has two tickets to Virginia's garden party today. It's the 3CR garden party this afternoon, but she can't make it, so she's happy to donate them. So if anyone wants to come along to the garden party, give us a call on 94190155 and pick up those couple of tickets for this afternoon's garden party. Just on community announcements, we do have a couple, and I'll actually read this one out. We had Peter Symes in the studio a couple of weeks ago talking about an event which is being held here in Melbourne at a couple of locations, which I'll detail, but it's Seeds for a Just Peace. It's a twin event hosted by the Global Gardens of Peace, an organisation called Sustain, the Australian Food Network, Just Food Collective and the Gaza Urban and Peri-Urban Agriculture Platform. This is a project which is supporting folks in Gaza to actually continue to cultivate plants and grow food. And I'll read it verbatim. Throughout the destruction of the Gaza Strip, urban families, especially women, have continued to try and grow food wherever they can. Using Bilardi, which is heritage seeds. The ability to successfully cultivate fast-growing vegetables has been critical for the health and survival of the peoples of Gaza, particularly younger children. Plants have been cultivated alongside tents in the rubble of bombed homes or in pots on the remaining rooftops. Inspiring determination supports both physical sustenance and mental health through the provision of food and urban greenery. The aim of the event, and I'll provide the details in a second, is to raise funds to support these local efforts and to consolidate seed preservation, urban agriculture and food production for the people of Gaza. At the event, you'll hear direct stories of food sovereignty, hope and resilience from several speakers across Gaza as well as Egypt and other places of forced displacement. Including some inspirational speakers from the Global Gardens of Peace. There are two events, one in the north and one in the west. So this Tuesday night, 25th of November from 7 to 9 at Schoolhouse Studios in Coburg on Victoria Street. There is a Seeds for Just Peace event. Tickets can be picked up at Humanitix. So if you were to type in Humanitix and Seeds for a Just Peace campaign, it'll take you to the booking site. And similarly, on Thursday, the 27th of November, at Borderlines Cooperative in Footscray, which is 30A Pickett Street, Footscray, there is another... It's the same event, which is repeated twice. So the Seeds for the Just Peace event, Schoolhouse Studios, Coburg, on Tuesday night, 25th, and then again at Borderlands Cooperative, Footscray, on Thursday afternoon. Sounds like an amazing event. The Global Gardens for Peace, you know, Peter chatted about this the other day, and it's an extraordinary project. They had it designed a children's playground, children's garden for Gaza, and were just about ready to turn the first sod. You know, it was all designed. They had a site, physical site. There was going to be, you know, quite an incredible garden, and we know what happened 18 months ago, or was it 2 years ago? Mm-hmm. You know, that turned into a war zone. Yeah. So this is really about sustenance, and it's quite an extraordinary program. Yeah, definitely. We'll also drop this afternoon, we'll drop some of that information into the socials. Yeah. Because that's Tuesday and Thursday,
and I think culture is rooted in food and growing food. Yep. And sharing food, and you know, it's part of your identity, so it's a beautiful project.
It is a beautiful project. Yep. Yeah. There is a cultural guided walk Saturday the 29th of November from 5 to 7. It is down at Macrae Foreshore. So the blurb is: experience country in a truly special way by joining living culture for a guided walk through Banksia, Clematis and Flax Lily Country in Macrae on the Mornington Peninsula. You'll hear stories of the land and the deep history that has shaped it for thousands of years. The walk concludes with a powerful Yidaki meditation session led by Uncle Lionel Launch. Followed by a tasting of bush foods paired with Etch Sparklings alcohol-free drinks. So if you wanted to touch a bit of country down in Macrae, there's a cultural guided walk which is slated for Saturday the 29th of November from 5 to 7. For details, go to the Etch Sparkling, so that's E-T-C-H Sparkling, or one word, .com.au, and click on events, and tickets for that event are $55 each. There are some open gardens coming up too, so I'm going to have a look at that in a second. November 30 series in Brunswick East are hosting a native nature strip planting workshop. Participants will get to know their local council guidelines for nature strip planting, develop a list of native plants and attractive that will attract pollinators, designed a scaled planting plan, and prepare a year-round maintenance schedule. Sounds like the work that you do, Emmeline. But so that's at series, November the 30th, a native nature strip planting workshop. If you were to go to the series website, you'll see the information for that. The workshop does have a cost. It's $94 for members or $85 for concession card holders or series members. Open gardens. This next weekend, there are a couple of open gardens. There's Garang Garden Nalia, 80 Lakeside Drive, Garang, Victoria, open from 10 till 4:30. And Greenfield, which is in 50 Greenfields Drive, Moriac. So there are a couple of open gardens event in rural Victoria, Garang Garden Nalia and down in Moriac. If 3CR, as usual, Open Gardens Victoria have provided a couple of double passes for 3CR listeners. So if 3CR listeners want to call in to attend the Garang Garden Nalia event at Garang or Greenfields at Moriac, give us a call on 9419 0155. So there's a bit on. It's been an extraordinary year for events, and I think it's just about to taper. But I don't know, we've probably read out 100 different community events over the course of spring this year. It's been quite extraordinary.
It's been amazing. I mean, having the Burnley Campus Discovery Day
in
there.
How did that go?
It was phenomenal. And thank you for, you know, promoting it as much as you did. We ended up with 500 people coming.
It's amazing.
Which, yeah, I know. I think it's the biggest ever.
500 people?
Yeah. Oh, that's and wonderful. The Friends of the Burnley Gardens, it was their biggest plant sale they've ever had. and the CWA ran out of cake. So everyone said it was a big success. It was really good.
Do you know what I love? Because I came down for the open day and all of the past students, like people are so connected to Burnley. And I, when I was a lot more beautiful back in the day, started my horticulture journey. Yeah, I've let myself go a bit, John, to be fair. But I started my journey at Burnley and I still feel that connection, you know, to the people who taught me and to the gardens and that sort of stuff. Like people want to come back and express their gratitude for what Burnley's done, like not only for horticulture, but for them personally. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, and that was really amazing because we had a series of research tours and talks that were in the garden, and there were actually a few alumni that went to everything, and it was like they treated it like a conference.
Yeah.
It was so exciting. Good.
Beautiful. Mm. Like the technical tours associated with the conference.
Yeah, because I guess because we're, you know, with the test garden and the plant trials and then Woody Meadows and the green roof, I guess, you know, it's all moving so fast. It's a good way to come and catch up with things before they get out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people may not know, but Burnley Gardens is open 365 days a year.
It's a public garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a cracking public garden.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
With an amazing history and,
yeah.
I mean, it goes back to the 1800s?
It does. So I think the gardens are 200 years old. And then Burnley itself is a horticultural teaching institute or place. Next year will be the 135th anniversary of continuous horticultural education, which is the longest in the whole wide world. So it's amazing.
Is that right?
Yeah. The continuous is the key word there because everyone else stopped during the war.
There are some older ones,
Continuously. Continuous. So, yeah, really amazing.
Horticulture stops for nothing in Melbourne.
No,
you know?
No.
It's the garden state.
Yeah, it is the garden state.
We're committed to it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's been one of my favourite things about being the director now is finding out those stories of how Burnley has, you know, influenced and affected people over time. And, yeah, people have a great fondness for Burnley and it's really special to be a part of that.
Yeah, it's cool. And you were talking about some of the, you know, that I was about to say bad something else, but like the women, like the pioneers, like a few came through Burnley, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the sort of story goes, and Sandy Pullman's done a lot of research on this as part of her PhD, but basically women students got to go to Burnley because Ina Higgins, she lobbied Luffman, who was the principal at the time and who the ponds are named after, to have female students be able to study because they weren't allowed to study in the early years.
Wow.
And so we're talking about 1911, I think, around then, and Luffman and the governor of agriculture, because they sort of ran it, said, okay, if you can get enough for a class, women can come. And a class in those days was anywhere between 8 and 12 students.
Yeah.
And so Ina managed to get 70 women students on the day to enroll.
Whoa.
And
in your face, Luffman.
Yeah. And but they weren't allowed to do the full degree. They were only allowed to do a part-time diploma. But from all accounts, the women did much better than the male students. Mm. And, it was pretty
phenomenal. Still happening, to be fair. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
It is. On average, women are getting taller than men now. Did you know this?
No.
Yeah, there's this worldwide phenomenon where women are getting taller and men are shrinking. And we're taken over, becoming Amazonians.
I think we're actually okay with that.
Yeah.
Help us.
And Claire, as you know, director of Burnley, I mean, that's on the heels of some giants, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, even in my career there, you know, like John Rayner, I mean, he's retiring at the end of the year and he's been an amazing mentor for me. And, yeah, I imagine at his retirement I'll be a bit teary. Mm. But, you know, just these people that have always been so generous about their knowledge and sharing. And I think Burnley as a whole, that's what it's about. It's about improving public landscapes and horticulture and the world around us. So yeah, pretty much no one holds back. You know, it's always to try and get people to be able to do things better.
Yeah, it's almost cause-driven.
I think so.
Yeah. You know, particularly in the light of biodiversity and climate crisis, and you know, horticulture needs to adapt.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think,
you know, learn things that are brand new.
Yeah, and I think that's the exciting bit, because plants have never had such a role to play in public landscapes. You know, really shifted, and I feel like everyone's valuing it. Even, you know, project managers and things like that might not be aligned with plants directly, they acknowledge its benefit and want them in projects. And I don't know, I feel like some of the barriers between horticulture, landscape architecture and those kind of professions, engineering, they're falling apart now, and people just want to collaborate to get good outcomes. So it's a super exciting time and a great time for Burnley, I think, to really lead that green infrastructure and urban greening.
Yep. And you've been in your director role for coming up to 2 years?
Coming up to 2 years, yeah.
We were chatting about, I mean, your qualification is Associate Professor of.
Yes.
Where does that sit? We were trying to work out yesterday where that sort of sits in the sort of academic hierarchy. Is it associate because it's not quite, or?
Yeah, it is actually. So when you have a PhD, you're a doctor. And as a person with a PhD who is a doctor, you could be a researcher, you could be a lecturer, or you could be a senior lecturer.
Yep.
And basically the step after senior lecturer is to become an associate professor. And so it is that you're on the way to becoming a professor. At a certain point you can become a professor. And it's a bit like, I guess, normal business, you apply for a promotion. So you put an argued case, and it is a bit like applying for a job. It goes to a panel. Of your peers who have those more senior positions, and they look at your case and see whether you have been working at that level that you can then be the next one up. And when you do the associate professor and the professor ones, they also go to international experts. Okay. So essentially, by the time you get to professor, you're showing that you have national and international recognition in your field as a leader. So,
and your field specifically is green infrastructure.
I mean, it goes to urban greening, but in the university you can't have more than one person that has the same title, so they always come up with a creative combination of urban horticulture, urban greening, green infrastructure for each of us.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you for that.
No worries.
We're going to change tack a bit here and bring Shona onto the line. Are you there, Shona? Hello, Shona. You there? I may have... Actually, we might have Lizzie on the line. Are you there, Lizzie?
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry, I went to the wrong person. Shona, we'll come to you in a second. Lizzie from Geelong, you've got a question about tree gardenias and propagating tree gardenias.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that's difficult or is it possible to do. I have one in a pot that I think I bought from Diggers probably 10 years ago or more, and I'm want to hand it on to my son-in-law, but I thought I might try and propagate a piece if I can.
I don't know. I know, like, you can just take the bulb out.
Do you mean tree dahlias?
Yeah, or the actual dahlia.
Is it gardenias? Gardenia.
Tree gardenia.
Did I say dahlia?
No, I think I've got it in my...
No, so no. Tree gardenia.
Oh.
A tree gardenia, yeah.
I'm not familiar with a tree gardenia.
I'm familiar with that. I think there might be one at Burnley. It's an old school, old fashioned plant. You see quite a few in the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne, and some of the old gardens. It has this big, almost cricket ball size seed. You can grow those from cuttings from, you know, either softwood or hardwood cuttings. But the technique that you would use with the new growth, just wait until it firms up so it's not too sappy or spongy. And when it sort of firms up a little bit, that would be the ideal condition for taking tip cuttings off gardenias. But so they'll propagate, as with a lot of other gardenias, they'll readily propagate from cuttings.
Oh, good. That's good to know, because I was listening to a gardening show. I don't know if it was yours or ABC or one of them, and they said, like, they're a bit hard to get and they're not as common as they used to be. And I thought, oh, well, I might give it a go.
Yeah, absolutely. It's are you flowering it? How big is the shrub?
It's about over 2 metres now.
Yeah, so fantastic.
It's quite big for a pot.
And it's one of those gardenias that will actually take, you know, some quite harder, much harsher conditions than, you know, a lot of the garden variety.
Oh, will it ever. This one's been close to garden heaven a couple of times.
tip cuttings would be the way to go for the gardenias.
Okay, any particular time of the year to do that?
Oh, I don't know, maybe after the sort of flush of spring growth, when that new growth has firmed up. So, you know, okay. Potentially now would be a good time if that spring growth has hardened off.
Yeah, I mean, I can try some now and some, you know, in a month or so and just keep trying.
Terrific. Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling in. Yeah, good luck with the tree garden. Call back and let us know how you get on.
Thank you very much.
Okay, cheers for now.
Bye-bye.
And we have Shona on the line there. Sorry, Shona, are you
no
there now?
No worries, I'm here.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
How are you going?
Shona, good. In the studio we have Russell, Claire and Emmeline. And Shona, look, I'd say that this is a really wonderful opportunity to have a chat with you. You're working with an organisation called GROW, which is a sort of a new enterprise which was launched, I think, this year and dedicated to empowering young First Nations Victorians to get involved with horticulture and gardening. So,
yes, that is correct.
Thanks for coming along today.
No worries.
How long have you been involved with the GROW team?
Probably for 7 months now.
7 months?
Yeah, so I pretty much had done a course with Kalara Foundation, and I had actually spoke with GROW and sort of like kind of, you know, found my way on wanting to do something, you know, completely different and wanting to like spend more like outdoors and learning probably more, you know, like about planting and just, yeah, like the, yeah, kind of like the GROW sort of like things, so, I guess. So, yeah, I've been with them for 7 months. Yeah.
Wonderful. And you've spent a little bit of time with Russ, who's in the studio this morning.
Yeah, been stuck with me. It's been rough, hasn't it, Shona?
Yeah. I've worked with him for 10 years. If you need some tips on wrangling Russ, feel free to reach out.
We've spent, like, a good, like, 9 weeks, down at Fed Square trying to, you know, map out different kind of things on, just a whole lot, like, different makeover and, like, soil testing and all that. So, it's been really good,
you know,
working with him. So, yeah, it's good.
Oh,
don't lie.
So, Shona. Thanks. You have to say that on air, Shona. I appreciate that. I'll buy you a coffee next time I see you. So Shona's in a team with Luana and Janali. So, these three have been down at Fed Square.
Great.
And we've kind of gone on this journey through site assessment, which was kind of cool. So Shona just touched on soil testing. But then you can tell the world, Shona, what else did we do in that 9 weeks?
From the beginning, we actually met Russell, you know, as like a team with like MAPCO. And then, we just went to the, I think it was the test gardens.
Yeah.
Kind of like walked us through, like the different type of plants and, different kind of like soils on, you know, how they're growing and, you know, the pressures of the waters and that. And then, we also just went for a bit of a trip down at
Granny? Cranbourne?
Yeah. Oh, you went to the Cranbourne Gardens.
Yeah, Cranbourne.
What did you think of that, Shona?
I've never been. That was, a whole, like, eye-opener to me because, it was just unreal to see, you know, how many, like, amazing plants, trees, and, it was really amazing out there, and, I liked it.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And then we went to
Grant's Picnic Grounds.
You went up to Grant's.
Grounds, yeah.
That was a fun day, hey?
It was, we, that was actually, it was really good because we actually kind of like wandered around and we actually done a fern tree like along the way. So, yeah, it was really, really cool because like I guess, you know, in the whole like, in the eye side of that, you know, like it kind of like shows, you know, us like different perspectives on how like the natives are actually grown instead of, you know, like picking them from like your local like plant shop. It's, you know, it's all like in front of you and you get to know, you know, the knowledge and like really understand, you know, where it actually comes from and
Yeah.
And what's really cool with this gang is they went to Grant's picnic ground, so it's quite a shady spot in Fed Square. So looked at cool temperate and warm temperate rainforest species predominantly. Yeah. And like Shona was saying, we went down the creek in at Grant's and saw the ferns that were down the bottom and the ferns were kind of in the middle and up the top, and they put together this planting design. So Shona and the gang like picked the species that they wanted based on how they looked.
Amazing.
And like what flowers they liked. Shona, you really like that shrub. It's Pimelia axiflora. You know that really... the one that had heaps of white flowers that you liked?
Yes, yeah, that was actually probably one of my favourite,
Yeah, that was cool. Yeah. So I think, like, to see the growth of you and Janali and Luana in 9-10 weeks is amazing, and you guys should be really proud of what you've done, and you've made a contribution to Fed Square, which is really cool. So, and I think personally it's... like, I've loved working with you guys. It's been really fun. And we're going to get you back. You're coming back next week, so that's exciting. Yeah. You're stuck with me for a few more weeks. Yeah.
Shona, how long does the traineeship go? Is it a traineeship, and does it have a sort of a limited period, or is it sort of an ongoing role for you?
Working with Grow? Oh, yes. So, yeah, that is a full-time opportunity. So,
amazing.
Obviously, when I was with the Kalara. So, me, Luana and Janali actually first met each other actually at the Kalara group, because us three, we sort of was going in the direction of, you know, what we wanted to go in, and which was, you know, yeah, just doing, like, native stuff and... planting, mowing and mulching and all that. So, it's definitely like a full-time job. Like, it's not like... Originally, and I think what it was, it was like a 3 month kind of like trial, and then it was meant to be just like, you know, kind of like see how you go, and then, you know, you're just meant to find like a job after that. But I think the Grow team really, you know, actually enjoyed seeing what we could actually like become out from that, and then they're like, you know, just put us on for full time. So it was really great.
You guys are rad. That's why.
Shona, thanks. Thanks for calling in. It's it sounds like it's a really lovely program. Congratulations on you know, being involved with it. Really interested to see, you know, how it develops over time. Mm. But it just it's wonderful. It sounds like a fantastic program. So good on you, and thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Shona.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
See you Friday.
Yeah, see you Friday.
Thanks, Shona.
All right, thank you. Bye.
It's just one of those layers to like Bundark, isn't it?
Yes.
It's, accessible.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that Shona.
Oh, it's a great program. It's beautiful. And to, like, they're really engaged. And I think, like, going through Grant's picnic ground and having a few moments down there on the creek and, you know, Luana was saying, you know, my ancestors could have walked here. And, you know, I think you... I certainly have got an appreciation for like that connection to country and land and your culture in a different way. You know, I think I'm getting emotional.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I think you know, I'm a middle-aged white guy who feels guilty about what we've done to this country, and that's why I'm obsessed with natives and conservation and all that sort of stuff. And you know, I don't have that lineage and that connection, and it was just like a privilege to be with those guys to kind of walk through you know, cool temp rainforests and kind of share those experiences. And, yeah, I think all three of them are going to go somewhere, you know, like they're dedicated and they get up and have a crack and jump on a mower and, you know, they're really engaged in the process. So, yeah, it's been, like, personally, it's been beautiful.
Yeah.
I've loved it.
Yeah, beautiful. And it is one of the objectives with the MAPCO project is to have that First Nations voice embedded.
First principle is First Nations first at MAPCO. Like that's what we're.
It's a motto, isn't it?
We're built on, and we want to live that and own that. And you know, I've got a First Nations director who's doing heaps of cool stuff, and First Nations creative producers, and you know, support a lot of First Nations artists, and now you know, horticulturalists and things like that. So like it is, it's not a throwaway line.
No,
at MAPCO, like they genuinely mean it. And, and want to help contribute. So, yeah, it's cool.
You know, what a privilege to be, you know, associated with a program like that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Good on you, Shona. And, shout out to The Grow. If people want to have a little bit more, you type in Grow, G-R-O-W, and...
Grow Gardens. Yeah.
I had a look at their website. Yeah, really super.
Yeah.
Super stuff. Emmeline, I was having a look at your website a couple of days ago, and your byline is, you know, creating sustainable gardens, nurturing wildlife, reconnecting people with nature, with a mission to foster understanding, enhancing urban and rural spaces, and promoting biodiversity.
Mm.
Is that a signature? Do you do work which is outside of that brief, or is that is completely your jam?
It's completely a jam, like. Sometimes the only time I ever do we've done something like full exotic gardens. We call them the green gardens.
Yeah,
and they're sometimes friends. Like one of them was I used to do aquarium design back in the day. So I used to plant tanks. I used to do aquascaping.
Yeah,
and I used to look after people's tanks everywhere because I loved all my critters. You know, I looked after turtles and different types of fish species. And
this is as a young child.
As a young child, but also as an adult. Yeah, so I ended up managing a aquarium when I was 18. I got the job there for a couple of years.
In Gippsland?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And then when I moved to Melbourne, I got another job at another aquarium. And, yeah, I was all managing all that. And then as a side hustle while I was at uni doing landscape architecture, I had my own business called Urban Menagerie. No one knew what a menagerie was.
Urban Menagerie.
Yeah, it was like...
It's the wrong century. You know?
It was, obviously. Yeah. But I was like, I have a menagerie because I had snakes and lizards and frogs at home.
Right.
You know, I loved it. I'm going off a path here.
Urban Menagerie is great.
I ended up working doing work for some people, and one in particular was the Medafferies, who own Mediterranean on Sydney Road.
Okay.
And, I did a massive fish tank for them. And it's funny how, like, years later it all comes back around because obviously I started my other business later on. And they're asking me, they're full Italian. They're like, we don't like flowers, we don't like bugs, we don't like animals. I like fish in a fish tank, but I don't want any of that. I just want a clean plant. I almost want it plastic. I was like, oh, all right. I can do a green garden. I know how to do those boxes, bowls and hedges and that's simple. Sorry out there. Like literally. So sometimes you do go off, and it was actually really fun because what we did was we just flipped the buxus and, you know, we do other things. We still put some natives through. We had like Elixir buxifolias. We had Ptosporum mismatus, which was not native, but lots of Lamandra, Myoporum, Raphiolepsis. We just did a whole range, and then the Mugo pines and created this great green garden. So, yeah, sometimes, very rarely, very seldom we do. But, yeah, most of it we always try and, yeah, that's philosophy.
Stick within that brief.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, I'm very passionate about water, so water systems. So, you know, when we're not doing wetlands or dams, you know, we're doing soaks in the garden and things like that, just so we can keep water within sight. And the way that these gardens respond is just incredible. But then what that does, then it promotes a whole range of different wildlife and things like that. I think that's why I like all those rural projects as well, because they have much more of an effect. You know, you're working with an environment
And, you know, coming from a farm, you know what is taken. And I think that that whole notion of what is caring for country in different aspects. Like, I do care for country. I love, you know, I think we need to really give back. So, yeah, those rural landscapes when we plant, we're thinking about those local species and that percentage that's allocated for, you know, the natural environment for those animals. So then when we are taking our part for agriculture, there's always a give back. You know, we take so much. Humans take so much.
A net gain in what you're doing.
Absolutely. And like, you know, we've worked on projects where we got growling grass frogs back and they do regenerative agriculture and, you know, we put the principles in there to be able to give that little bit back. And there is a gain because for this project, like the pollinators and how that actually helped with the landscape, how it improves the soil health, the water from the dams that have been fixed rather than it being all clay particles.
Yep.
We cap it with the soil, put the water plants all through. We put some native fish back, but the water that goes back into the troughs is crystal clear, and the cattle themselves are actually healthier because they're not, ingesting all that sediment.
Flocculant,
yeah. So, I'm like caring for country is. Yeah. I really do respect this land, and that's why I really take my hat off to like even nurturing other people who are wanting and who want to come back. Because us humans and what we are, we do take a lot from this earth. So
sure do.
I think, yeah.
Would I be able to walk into a STEM landscape and, like, do you have a signature? Like Paul Bangay, you could walk into a Paul Bangay garden and say, that's a Paul Bangay garden. Would you be able to walk into a STEM landscape and say, like,
we say that sometimes. I think you can. Like, some people send us a photo and say, is this yours? So obviously there's something going on.
Yeah.
But we're very varied, like, we will respond to site and the palette will change, but there will be signatures. Like, I mean, for example, like what Russ has brought in, you'll see some species like this popping through. Like you'll see signature plants that are through there, and I guess that's a signature. But, no, we respond to site a lot. Like we'll check the soil profile and the plants will be adapted to that. And that's what makes us really, really good. Not saying like beating my drum, but it does because we are looking at the different sites and what plants will work and respond to that area, whether it be, you know, really wet site, boggy, it could be really dry. You know, we work on rural landscapes that are extreme hostile conditions. Yeah, you know, we'll look at the indigenous species, native species, and what else would work in there. So like we're talking about alpine species are incredibly hardy as a native plant to pop in. They do, every time I see anything alpine, I'm like, Give it a go. It's really good.
And make those observations.
Veronica Formosa, not as good in the flower, but...
I love it, man, as a plant.
It's a credible plant. And the form, and it will grow anywhere. Yep. And it's fantastic in the air. You want something on a roof garden, but yeah.
It's quite adaptable, actually, because we had it in the forest garden at Cranbourne. Yeah. I can't say we anymore. How long have I got that for? 10 years or something?
Yeah, 10 years.
But it was in quite wet conditions.
Yeah.
But I've seen it in pretty dry as well. It's quite adaptable.
All over. And then, combination with rocky outcrops as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Loves it. It's a fantastic. And it's one of those plants that we use because when you are dealing with sites that has nothing, you're kind of looking for species that are going to give a little bit of cover so then you can start to plug in some of the more finicky species later on. And they're one of those plants that I'm like, I can bang that in straight away.
They're really fun to prune too. We're done and they get the new shoots and that sort of stuff, you know. Perfect for those kind of perennial gardens and stuff.
Yeah.
Claire, are you seeing that sort of biodiversity agenda expressed in the course materials now?
Definitely. Most of the students that come these days, I'd say that's one of their core passions, and they're really into native and indigenous plants. I mean, sometimes it's interesting conversations, you know, because sometimes there's such an agenda around the indigenous plants, especially, and they want to put them everywhere. And you go, yeah, that's great, but they do need a bit of love and they need a bit of care to get going, and you do need to understand them in terms of maintenance. So we can't necessarily have that everywhere, but where we have it, we should treat it really well so that it looks as amazing as it can. But, yeah, I'd say biodiversity, and just, you know, responding to the changing climate and wanting to leave it a better place, I'd say that was unanimously why everyone comes to Burnley.
Yeah. It's a drive.
It is a drive.
It's interesting with Indigenous plants. I think there's still quite a lot of work around selecting out these things. And, so predominantly...
And effectively gardening with them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a fair fight, an Indigenous plant that you've collected from a bushland reserve compared to a plant that's been, you know, selected or finely bred or hybridised and that sort of stuff. So I think obviously if you're getting into bush regeneration, like you want to maintain as much genetic diversity as possible, like so you have those kind of, you know, you're retaining adaptive potential, you know, in response to things like climate and that sort of stuff. But if in a garden sense, like you want hardy garden plants. And I think like for all the nursery people out there, like there is a niche, like with, you know, Indigenous Melbourne plants and like some of the Western Plains forest probably been selected a bit more than Sandy Heathland things. So it's happening, but like there's still so much work to do because some of the peas are ridiculous, like the bossiers and aiotis and like those shrubby things, but they're so bloody finicky.
Yeah.
Like if you could find a couple of those that are,
Amenable to cultivation.
It'd be amazing.
Yeah. It's a big thing where like there seems to be like this whole talk about Indigenous species, but it's like it's about how we think about our landscapes. Like, if you're on a reserve, if you're on parkland or, you know, or somewhere where there's, like, intact bushland, you know, you need to start thinking about what are those Indigenous species for those areas. That's appropriate. If it's coming into the city, you've got a garden. It's a garden and it's changed, just altered. And I think that's where it's, like, always a mixture and that percentage of having it. So there's, like, a mix of native, Indigenous and exotic.
Mm-hmm.
And just to realise that when you are in these city environments, the way the animals are, like the biodiversity in cities is because of the plants that we have. There's a whole new ecology that we've created in cities. Like you're seeing the biodiversity like nothing else, you know. So
because the nature of the planting.
Absolutely.
Happening.
And you see the hierarchies change because there is more natives and Indigenous coming in. And when I say Indigenous, it might not be anymore because you sort of bring it from other areas, you know, and they could be crossed. So unless you're really going to your local Indigenous nursery and you're plugging in something from your local area, like, you know, sometimes we've actually done it sometimes where we couldn't get a plant. We might have got some Indigenous stock from Bundoora and then we might have plugged it somewhere in Toorak. That's not Indigenous anymore because we've taken it away from that area. So we have to be kind of clear about that. But I think, when we're working on projects that are fringing where you want to restore some ecologies, that's when we really need to prioritise those Indigenous plants.
Yeah.
And we also need to learn about them and how they respond in all those different environments, like what we're doing in our garden, we can see what we can put in.
And there's you know, in the test garden, a good example this week as well is the Dianthus Carthusiorum, like had Caper Whites and Meadow Argus in there. And
sitting on a carnation by default.
Wild, you know, and just loving life. So, you know, there's, it's complex.
Yeah,
you know?
It's very complex.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, there's a whole bunch of research around Indigenous species promoting, like, increased biodiversity and, you know, it's all that co-evolution and adaptation stuff going on in the background. But, like, there's a bunch of exotic species or native species from outside that range that are doing some work.
Yeah.
You know,
And sometimes it happens where, you know, you'd be in an environment where you've got predominantly native species and that's why people bring exotic species in. And you kind of got a percentage where you can do that. But then slowly what happens is it shifts and you lose your native value.
Yeah.
And that's where I think everyone needs to just stay, like, in this sort of idea of what is that balance of, just like within farming, you know, it's like what is that balance of preserving something that might be a bit more local and plugging some of the things that might not be, but what is that balance? That's what I think
and
is
it's that
the takeaway.
Novel ecosystem approach to creating biodiverse urban landscapes. And novel being not attempting to sort of recreate something that was there pre-European condition.
And I think that's the exciting space we're in, actually. It's taking principles that we can learn from those ecosystems and modify it to suit site.
You're listening to the 3CR Garden Show. My name's John Arnott, joined today by Claire Farrell, Russell Larkin, Emmeline Bowman. We've had a couple of messages come through, Vicky and Peter from Notting Hill. There's an open garden today at Nakara, which is 470 Berwick Road, Narre Warren East. Huge property, 85,000 square metres, a quarter is cultivated gardens. It sounds like it's quite the event out there. Phil Vaughan selling plants today. There's a sausage sizzle out there. And so there's an open garden, Nakara, 470 Berwick Road, Wandon, Narre Warren East, open from 10 till 4:30. Lizzie from Geelong has just mentioned, of Geelong, Lyle at Roy Rama Nursery in Lara has three tree gardenias for sale at the moment, and an absolutely colossus specimen in Darling Street, South Yarra. There's a question about bej nausea and why it might be dropping flowers as soon as the person touches it. It's the first time that it's happened in 8 years. Bej nausea being, it's a bit agave-like.
I don't know.
No? Okay. That might be a carryover for next week as well. We've got some homework. We've got the bej nausea and we've got the scedoxys to carry over. Oh, there's a message here. For John Arnott, happy birthday, Papa, from Elsie and Asher.
Is it your birthday?
It's your birthday.
There we go. I've just been reminded. I've forgotten about it.
Oh, happy birthday.
We would have started with that.
From lovely Elsie and Asher.
You share the same birthday as Chloe Foster's dad.
Oh, really?
Happy birthday, Stavros, too.
Yes, indeed. Thanks for that, Elsie and
what's
Asher.
What's that, 80 for you, John? Yeah. You look great, by the way.
Yeah. It's like,
The garden at 470 Berwick Road, Narre Warren East, is actually a Phil Johnson designed garden. So it'll have those elements of, you know, talking about style and influence, and I'm sure that'll be naturalistic and there might be some water in the mix as well.
Mm. Yeah.
So it sounds like a really nice garden out there at 470 Berwick Road, Narre Warren East. Beauty.
Look at, we've talked, it's we have, gone quick.
We have, there's a couple of plants here. We've mentioned Claire's dahlia, but what's the other thing you've got there, Claire?
Oh, well, actually, can I plug the Woody Meadow guidelines?
Yes, of course you can. Sorry about that.
No, you're right. Yep. So I've been on the show before and you've heard me talk about Woody Meadow guidelines, but they're essentially using native Australian trees and shrubs as naturalistic plantings, maintained by coppicing, so that's super hard pruning, species diverse, really adaptable, really resilient. And we finally have our guidelines for everyone to adapt and take this and make it their own. They're free, available on our website, so the Woody Meadow I think project, but if you look up Woody Meadows, you'll find our Uni Melb website. They've been out for a week and we're super excited that we've had 7,000 downloads. So that's clearly a need.
It's a good start.
Yeah, a good start. And I look forward to hearing what people do with that. But yeah, thanks, John.
No, that's remarkable. So where could people go and see Woody Meadows? Like, could you just mention half a dozen locations?
Half a dozen. The entrance of the Burnley campus has some. There's a really awesome one in Balaclava at Nightingale Road. There's a one that's just been coppiced in Yarraville in Cumming Reserve. Essentially, we've gone Canberra, Sydney, Melbourne, obviously, through into South Australia and into Perth. And in the guidelines, there's case studies. And on our website, you can do the Find a Woody Meadow and find out about plantings that might be near you that you can check out as well.
Fantastic. Is there an application for that style of horticulture in people's home gardens?
Yeah, I think if... and I do a little bit to certain plants in my home garden. I have Indigofera australis and I coppice that, and that's sitting alongside cannas and other crazy things.
Wonderful.
But, look, I think if... Even tip pruning at planting of natives, so taking away a third of the foliage, just bunch it up, cut it across, and then plant it, I think you'll get better outcomes with the growth of natives. So I think those principles hold. And if you wanted to do it in your home garden, you could selectively hard prune some in one year and some in another if you didn't want it to be as clean slate as it is in these public landscapes. But Woody Meadows, they were designed to replace Lemandra land, so it was about something that anyone could do at broad scale. So you can tinker with it, but I think there's some beautiful principles and some nice plant lists that anyone could use at home.
Yeah, and anything which is on the woody meadow plant list will take that heavy, heavy pruning.
And what we found is most Australian shrubs and trees will. In all of our trials, and I think it's over 300 species we've played with now, basically 85% of plants will come back. There's just a few things in the Asteraceae that you might be a bit careful with, but otherwise everything likes a chop.
Yeah. Mm. And, you know, some common garden variety things like the Alleogyne.
Oh, yeah. It needs it.
It needs it. Yeah. Because these great big Alleogynes that haven't been pruned for...
And they fall apart.
And they fall apart, yeah.
Because they're resource acquisitive, if we thought about those. Yeah.
Do you think the Alleogyne, which is in that condition, that great big, you know, 2.5 metre by 2.5 metre ball, would that take a hard prune? Or is there a point...
I don't know. Yeah. I need to go back to Birung Ma. They were a bit naughty and they didn't do the coppicing as frequently as they should have, so they left it a long time for this last chop. And I'm a little bit nervous, but I look forward to walking past and seeing if they've sprouted. But if they've sprouted, they're 10 years old, so that would be a good indication.
Sure.
But definitely we've done up to sort of 7 years and they will resprout.
They'll resprout, yeah. Are there any woody meadow... are you looking to do any woody meadow type things with the MAPCO project? Or
like
is it a different...
There's different areas based on aspect and light and that sort of stuff. So there's definitely areas that are a bit more shrubby, but not in the same way. It's kind of a different application. I think what's great about both of them, and woody meadows probably, well, it definitely is further down the track, like understanding how you manage these landscapes at scale. So I think like Lakbundup in many ways is kind of a hybrid between a, you know, herbaceous meadow or a grassy meadow and a woody meadow. So there's still a lot to learn around how you're going to manage that in the future and that sort of stuff. But I think all three have applications depending on landscape topology and that sort of stuff.
And I think that's the thing. It's just giving people the freedom to play with plants now and think about these mixes and what works and how you can maintain them. It's kind of like the modern perennial border in some ways that we're getting to.
Yep.
But it's like, how do we do this at scale with plants that have never been used in that way before?
Yeah. And also land managers, like, you know, horticulturalists who are looking after these landscapes freak out when there's a new style of planting or gardening or whatever, you know, there's a piece in there, and that's why Burnley's so good, because the science becomes these like amazing guides that anybody could use. Like you can't do this and not give people the tools to be able to support these landscapes. So
And I'm looking forward to not holding their hand anymore.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, everyone goes coppicing, that sounds great, and then they go to do it and they all freak out. But we have videos on our website too, so that people can see how hard we go and feel confident.
Beautiful.
So yeah, it is the manual.
Yeah.
For woody meadow management.
Yeah.
People are able to download it.
Download it, and if you do put one in, we'd love to hear about it. We'd like to keep a track of where it goes and how people interpret it. Super exciting.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and downloadable. Is there a website that folks can go to?
Yeah, the Woody Meadow website. So it should be UniMelb, Woody Meadow, and it might be project. .edu.au.
Beautiful. Okay, so download your copy of the... And congratulations on the publication. It's a really beautiful...
Yeah, it's great. And I should mention it's with John Rayner and Rachel Bathgate as well. Wouldn't it happen? Woody Meadows is a huge team effort.
Yeah.
Good work, guys. It's amazing.
We're winding the show up here. So my name's John Arnott. Today I've been joined by Claire Farrell from the Burnley Gardens. Thanks so much for coming in, Claire.
Pleasure, John.
Congratulations on the Woody Meadow publication. For those, just a reminder that the Burnley Gardens is a publicly open garden, and get out there and have a look. It's quite magnificent. Emmeline Bowman from STEM Landscape Architecture and Design.
Thank you.
Thanks for this year. I don't think you're rostered back on for the 3CR Garden Show for the rest of this year. So thanks for coming in.
Is it?
And being such a great supporter of the 3CR Garden Show.
It's such a pleasure. It's so nice to be here and talk with all you guys.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And same to you, Russ. You've been in, I don't know, half a dozen times this year. thanks for the year. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for teeing up Shona today. That was, that was really special to hear from.
They're a great gang.
From Shona. Yeah.
And happy birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Everyone, happy birthday. Let him know. Call in.
No.
No, I'm joking.
Thanks to Labana for producing today. Thanks to Shona and the Grow team. Thanks to Daniel Jackson and Liam Killick for their support with the show, the show's social media. Next week's show looks terrific. It's Chloe Foster, Fermi D'Souza, Jane Tonkin and Tex Moon, and we've got some carryover actions coming out of that.
It's a good one. Mm.
Stick around for the alternative news, and thanks for listening in, folks.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.